Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Pools.
And Paula's here today.
Yay!
Hi.
Yay!
Hi,
Well,
Paula.
welcome in, Paula.
Thank you.
Our longtime listeners will remember Paula from having been on the show before, but if you're a first-time listener, Paula is the co-founder of strikefans.com, which is a great resource if you have any questions about the Strike series. But anyway, today we'll be continuing our reread of the Ink Black Heart, this time covering chapters 73 through 77 of part 4. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of the Ink Black Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we get started on talking about these chapters for this episode, one thing that we did want to touch on is this really excellent video that we got tagged in from a YouTube account called Fandom Hype, and it's talking about the different theories for who could have killed Leda.
Yeah, I was really excited when we got this email last week. I was nervous at first. Were you nervous to watch it, Kins?
Yeah, up until the point at which this person said, "It's not bad, I promise," I was like, okay, whew. I hope it wasn't one of those ones that's like, oh, this is ridiculous, which, unfortunately is, not something we can say for some of the other theories in this video.
So it talks about our theory that Gillespie did it, and I loved the video. It made me laugh all the way through, but I pretty much agree with every assessment, including the criticisms of our theory. So she touched on some of the weaker, more speculative points, and I think improved on them with an amazing counter where Whitaker was the one who noticed the money missing, but wrote to Gillespie and blackmailed him in Leda's name. And I think that's great.
I think that is so smart. That would be an amazing twist.
It
Very
would
cool.
be. It would answer the problems with our theories of how Leda knew.
Yeah, it would. Really, really clever.
So thank you so much for emailing that to us and for making the video in the first place because I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. That was very funny.
Yeah, I really loved the beginning just talking about the romance that if you don't see it, I don't know how to talk to you because I feel that deep in my soul.
Same.
Absolutely. We did not pick a Q&A.
Oh, did we run out?
There's like one Q&A I think that we have left that we can like put wherever we want, but we did run out of Q&As.
Oh, we did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we can save that for next time. Oh, you know what's something cool that we can mention? The paperback for Ink Black Heart came out. And Katie did a check for the epigraphs that were incorrect. And in her Ink Black Heart paperback, they've all been corrected.
Oh,
Ah,
excellent. Very
right.
nice.
I think that we can take credit for that.
I haven't checked my paperback yet, but that's exciting. Kenz, you got yours early.
I did get mine early. Yeah. My version still has all the incorrect ones in it. So I feel like, oh no, I might have to get another copy of Ink Black Heart. Oh
I kind of want to
no.
grab mine and see. Okay, let me check. 25. It's oh, mine has not been corrected either.
Ooh.
29 is still
Oh.
saying Jean Ingelow at one again. Let's see, the next one is 34. Yeah, Joanna Baillie London, it's still saying.
Oh.
37. So
Damn.
I guess
We don't get a
we
corrected
don't get a
version.
correct version.
Well,
Yeah,
that's not
37 still
fair.
wrong. They must all be still wrong.
Oh.
Weird. Well, that's interesting.
Oh wait, yours has the cursive version on it. What
Oh my
the hell?
God,
Oh
you
my goodness.
scared
I'm
me.
sorry. Mine doesn't look like that.
No, what does yours look like?
Mine has the regular block face type. I'm sorry. I love the ones with the cursive cover on it. Oh my goodness. That's amazing.
All right, should we jump in to 73?
Yes.
All right, in chapter 73, Morehouse and Paperwhite come up with a plan.
The epigraph to chapter 73. My rival his mischief devises. What matter? His treachery is void. I scorn him. I know whose the prize is. And that is from the last performance by May Kendall.
Ooh, I really like this one because I think it's another one that fools you on the first read. Initially, I thought this was Morehouse thinking about Annamie and how he's become his rival and he's making a plan to take him down. But really, I think it's Gus thinking about how Morehouse has betrayed him and he's going to be the one with the prize at the end after, murder.
Yes, totally agree. And this poem is so good for this situation because in it, the lover has won the affections of the woman he loves, but it's all a play, a comedy. It's that sort of life is but a play metaphor. He has her love until the curtains go down. And then it reads, and I, the poor fortunate lover, am standing alone on the stage and all the performance is over. I think that this is kind of a hint towards the fact that this relationship between Paperwhite and Morehouse is a falsehood. And to me, that kind of ominous ending suggests that it's about to come to a close.
Uh-huh.
And not a good one.
No.
So today's first chapter is another chat chapter, obviously, with a few different conversations going on. There is a moderator channel, which has Borkle Drek, Anime, and Morehouse, and then two private channel conversations, one between Anime and Morehouse, and then another one between Morehouse and Paperwhite. To start off, we're going to talk about what's going on in the moderator channel, and Borkle Drek welcomes Morehouse in and says the numbers are down in the game.
Yeah, someone remind me why Anime says not for long. What was Maverick's next announcement going to be?
I don't think we know that. Although we do know that Josh was pushing back against changing Hardy to a human. Mm-hmm. So maybe the studio caved and they're going to announce that Hardy would appear in his OG form. It just feels like that's the kind of announcement that Anime would have seen as his own personal triumph.
I hope that that's it.
Yeah, me too.
I still can't stand the idea that they were going to change him to a human.
No.
Cannot have this fictional thing inside of another fictional thing be destroyed like this. I won't stand for it.
When Anime says that he'll tell Borkle Drek what Maverick is planning once he takes over from Morehouse, that felt really sinister to me. The whole, if Morehouse has an accident, I mean, is not super convincing in hindsight.
Things like this just remind me of how reckless Gus is, mm-hmm. and or how invincible he feels. You don't go throwing out someone having an accident when you're planning on murdering them. That's just basic crime 101.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so typical of a narcissistic sociopath or whatever he is.
Yeah.
I mean, he thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, especially the chat room. Yeah. And he thinks he can say and do anything and nobody's smart enough to catch him.
Yeah, smartest guy in the chat room. That's good.
But Lindsay, I like your basic crime 101. I think you should teach crime classes.
That sounds a little bit different than the criminology classes I took, but
no, this is how to do crime.
Yeah.
A school for criminals.
So one other thing that Borkle Drek mentions is that they think that Anime is a friend of Josh Blaze.
It's a really vague guess. That casts a wide net.
Yeah.
I think that Borkle Drek should really be more specific if he's going to go so far as to call this a theory, because there are standards for what we can call a theory. I see Lindsay laughing.
There should be. It just seems to me like Borkle Drek is the Netley of Drek's game, really.
I can believe that.
Anime might have eventually killed him just out of annoyance.
Like right up there with Janice.
Yeah, Janice poisoning Irene because she's annoying.
Moving on to the next chat that's between Anime and Morehouse. We have Anime reaching out to Morehouse to check in on him and kind of see how he's doing.
Yeah, it's so sad to see. He's kind of being friendly here, calling him Wah, asking him how exams are going, all while planning his murder. Although, I couldn't help but notice this small detail that Anime is getting it wrong that Morehouse had exams. Morehouse corrects him and says it's research. But I don't know, maybe it suggests a lack of interest or care in Morehouse's actual life.
See, I thought that what he was doing was deliberately trying to trivialize and minimize Morehouse's position here, because Morehouse is a doctor. He holds a PhD. He doesn't have exams to sit, and he hasn't for a while. So Anime is treating him like he's still a student, just to denigrate him.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, Anime's got to be extremely jealous of Morehouse's real life success. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's going to take every opportunity he can to cut him down to make himself feel better.
Ooh, literally.
Oh my God. Oh. Mm. Jesus. Sorry.
So there's this bit in the chat between Anime and Morehouse where it's talking about, you know, and here she is, when it talks about Paperwhite. So how in the hell would Anime, outside of being Paperwhite himself, know that Paperwhite had joined the game? Unless the whole point here is to just have people think that he can see everything without that necessarily being the truth.
I didn't find that part weird, because I've always assumed that you have your side chats going on, but you can still see the main game. And I think that it must say, so-and-so has entered the game, in a similar way that it does with the chats, or you can kind of see them walking around.
Yeah, that's what I assumed as well.
But the bit about this that I did find weird was when Anime said that he'll doubt it will take Paperwhite long to show up now that Morehouse is in the game. And then she immediately turns up. And that's weird because pretending that Paperwhite is real for a second, how would you know, how would she know who is in the game if you're not currently already logged in as someone else? Do you know what I mean? How would Paperwhite know that Morehouse was in the game and then join?
Oh, shit, you're right. Mm-hmm. I didn't pick up on that. And clearly neither does Morehouse, because that's,
Yeah, he should have made it more realistic by waiting a little bit and then having her come in.
Bit too coincidental.
Yeah, maybe Morehouse dismissed it as a joke, but it's pretty telling to me that Gus is also Paperwhite, because it doesn't make sense. If that makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. Just the fact of Paperwhite turning up the second Morehouse does, it's too much of a coincidence. You add an enemy's joke, that's a smoking gun. He really is getting really arrogant.
There's that lovely narcissistic sociopath behavior.
He's probably being more careless with Morehouse because he knows that he's planning on killing him soon.
Literally the next day.
Yeah. That's a good point.
God damn it.
He can be sloppy.
Oh, I hate this.
Morehouse was a tough one. A tough death. Mm-hmm. I think I've only felt that kind of sadness and like, I wish I could change this fictional thing with Margot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As strongly.
Margot was very upsetting.
Yeah. But Morehouse, I feel that as well.
So speaking of Paperwhite and Morehouse, that's the next chat we're going to get to here. With this chat, we see Paperwhite reaching out to Morehouse and they discuss what happened to Vile Petura at the tube platform.
I know we always say this, but how different does reading this feel now that you know, as opposed to when you first read it, because it's so sinister now.
Also, these chats are starting to drop some more hints about Morehouse's real identity, because Enemy told him that he's a physicist earlier, and now Paperwhite is talking about, you know, his hot fellow scientists. So it's a clue to the reader about who Morehouse is, and I feel like it's a bit suspicious that both Enemy and Paperwhite bring up the same thing in such quick succession.
The first read through of this, Paperwhite and Morehouse working together to try and find Robin, feels really hopeful. Just like the last time that they mentioned going to the agency, it just felt like, okay, yes, somebody from within the game is going to try and help make this better.
And I just really like that Morehouse was so spot on in how he saw the situation. He was technically wrong that Strike and Robin were following Anime, because they weren't really. But Anime is the one who they're interested in, not the Havening. And he's accurately guessing that the Havening is wrong and thinking that they're the ones being investigated. I know that it's because he could have been such an asset to the investigation that he had to be killed, but it's so sad to see this and then know it's coming.
It is. Oh, I would have so loved to see a scene of Robin and interviewing Vikas or talking to him and the whole thing coming out. It would have been so good.
It would have, yeah.
God damn it.
Speaking of that, Morehouse says, not long till we meet then, to Paperwhite, and he's gonna be dead in less than 10 chapters.
According to these chat timestamps, he actually only has a little over 24 hours left to live, because the last chat he has with Paperwhite starts at 11:30 p.m. on June 6th, and this is the afternoon of June 5th.
Oh, wow.
And think about it, too. I mean, what a wonderful person he was. I mean, he overcame physical challenges, developed his brilliant mind to actually contribute to the world.
Yeah.
And this creep is going to dispatch with him.
When Anime said the thing to Borkeldrek about Morehouse having an accident, do any of you remember if you knew it was coming?
I don't remember exactly, but I think I was definitely worried about his safety. I was thinking, obviously, something is going to stop him from contacting Robin and Strike, because that's just too easy.
I remember having a bad feeling about it, just the dynamic in general between Anime and Morehouse. I mean, Anime was aggressive and rude with everyone, but you'd think he would have been somewhat more easygoing with his co-creator. And I don't know. I've always just kind of been paranoid when it comes to chat rooms anyway. And I just assumed that Anime could see all the chats.
I didn't think that Anime could see them, because I think he doesn't know how to code. And so if he had that capability, I thought that Morehouse would be the one to give it to him.
Yeah, maybe so.
But I think that's what he's doing with Paperwhite, is to gain that access that he couldn't see everywhere else. Are we ready for 74?
Let's do it. All right. In chapter 74, Strike gets ready to stay the night with Robin.
I love the way you worded that.
The epigraph for this chapter. Yet, sayest thou, spies around us roam, that there is risk our mutual blood may redden in some lonely wood the knife of treachery? And that is The Wood by Charlotte Bronte.
Yeah, I just think this is talking about the threat of the happening around them, and they're in it together.
They sure are. We've had this poem before in chapter 19, and it was one of my absolute favorites. I really felt it spoke to Strike and Robin. But I think that the poem itself fits what's happening here so well, because it's a plea from the speaker to her beloved to face danger together, to trust in her strength and let her bolster his. So not only are these lines perfect for the threat that the happening poses, but the larger theme is speaking to Strike's desire to stay with Robin, to be with her and protect her, to make sure she isn't alone and have her be with him so he's not alone. And this gives me some emotions. And yeah, if I had to recommend one poem to read from these epigraphs, it'd be this one. I love it so much.
All right, to start out this chapter, we come back to Strike, and we see him reaping the benefits of having a positive perspective when he thinks, if there was one upside to getting bombed out of his home and office, thought Strike, it was that it gave him a cast iron excuse not to have dinner with Madeline that night. Come on, buddy, you gotta break up with her.
I mean, I certainly love a positive outlook, and he's found one.
He found that silver lining.
Yeah, he's a glass half full kind of guy. When he starts thinking about the fact that he gets to spend the night at Robin's, and he's gotten rid of that couch, I feel like this bombing is really, he's going to be like, his glass is overflowing.
I'm not sure he thinks about the couch in his silver linings, does he?
Well, it always annoys him a little, doesn't it? When it makes that sound.
What sound?
You know what sound, Lindsay. You know.
I don't know what you're talking
about. Say the word.
I don't even
saying
remember it.
Say the word.
Yeah, I think it's it bothers him because it only does it when he sits on it.
Pretty much.
Maybe I'm projecting here, but it feels almost cheerful to me. Mm. And I think he's just so happy to not be going to Madeline's, but also going to Robin's.
Yeah, you're not projecting. That man is excited. He's in a good mood.
Nice to be in such a good mood after a bombing.
Yeah.
I still think that it's a really big deal that he actually chose staying with Robin over going to a hotel. Because just think about it. The man who always chooses solitude, he's now choosing to spend that time with Robin. And aww, honestly, as a person who also enjoys time to myself, there are many perks, so many perks of choosing a hotel. You don't have to share a bathroom. You don't have to feel like you're in the way. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have had to buy pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that mattered. He chose Robin.
You're so right. And yeah, I also love a hotel. I literally cannot think of a situation where I would choose to stay with a person rather than in a hotel.
Same.
I mean, like, maybe if I was literally broke or if I was in love with the person. That's it. Those are the two reasons. And we know that Strike is flush with cash. So
yeah, it just makes me think of the prologue where he would have loved to spend hours more sitting there with her at the Ritz. Mm-hmm. I just think it really speaks to the change in him where mm-hmm. he's further questioning if solitude is what he really wants. And we're seeing him start to choose Robin over that.
Aww. Please tell me that I'm not the only totally normal person who looked up what kind of underwear and PJs that Superdrug sells, right?
I mean, I hadn't, but now I kind of want to. What did you find?
Honestly, their selection was pretty disappointing for the most part. Their clothing selection for men is definitely limited from what I was able to find, unless they have more stuff in their actual stores than what they have online.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I was able to find, I was just able to find like boxer briefs. And then there were some gray sweatpants, which if you know, you know.
Got it.
Okay.
I know you know what I mean.
I know. I get it, Jens.
Okay.
Madeline's reaction when Strike calls to tell her what happened feels so gossipy to me. Why is she sharing that with her staff? That's none of their business, BBC News report or no.
I'll be honest. So I don't think this specifically was really a weird or bad thing for her to do, because it feels like kind of natural to me. She had just gasped and said, oh my God. So I imagine whoever she was speaking to asked if something was wrong. I don't know. I think what it really is that this, along with the fact that she referred to him as Corm, implies to me that she talks about him a lot. And I think that's the thing that's bothering him. Maybe not so much this specific instance.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I just think it's in Madeline's nature to share with those around her. And I mean, who could blame her dating Strike? When you're excited about a new beau and you're naturally talkative, you're going to chatter about him to anyone who will listen. However, a private detective obviously needs a significant other with discretion.
Yeah.
So yeah, he just needs to dump her now.
Or yesterday.
Right. Yeah. I guess I would just hope that Madeline would pick up on Strike's need for discretion, because it's not like he's never brought it up before now.
That's fair.
And, you know, right. Have some self-restraint. I don't know. Maybe I'm judging her against Robin, but I'm definitely kind of rolling my eyes at her here.
It's definitely not a good thing for Strike. But in a normal situation, it doesn't bother me as much.
Absolutely, yeah. It just really makes Robin's discretion stand out here.
Oh, it super does. Remember Robin's very first days with him when Lucy was trying to get info out of her and Robin was giving nothing away because her concern was for Strike's privacy and his preferences? He's known since the very beginning that he can trust Robin in the way that he knows he can't trust Madeline.
I wish that Strike didn't lie to Madeline here about where he's staying, because it's such a dumb lie.
I have to say, I kind of like it because the payoff is so entertaining when she figures it out. And I think it's a sign that he knows how his relationship with Robin is interpreted by others.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like the parallels with Robin in Lethal White to how she would lie to Matthew. Like that lie about Vanessa's sunglasses.
Yeah, all of that. And also, I like it because this is the lie that leads directly to the breakup. So ooh. I'm cheering him on. Good
job, Strike.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It says, after Strike had hung up, he noticed how much lighter of heart he felt. Knowing that he didn't have to go to Pimlico that night, he reached automatically into his pocket for a celebratory cigarette.
A celebratory cigarette.
This line made me really excited when I first read it, because as frustrating as it is that he hasn't already broken up with her, you can tell it's coming soon. And I was thrilled.
Oh, same. Was there a matching line from Lethal White where Robin doesn't want to examine how much happier or lighter of heart she felt with Strike?
Of course.
Is there? Course, am I imagining that?
No.
There are a couple of different instances. So there's one where Robin mentions feeling lighter of heart, which is in the chapter where she finds Sarah Shadlock's earrings in her and Matthew's bed. And she says, trying not to focus on how much lighter of heart she felt once Matthew had left the house, Robin occupied herself with laundry, etc.
You know what? That is a parallel.
And then there's another one from Lethal White, which is one of my favorite ones from Lethal White, where it says, a pint, a hot day in August, a well-paid job, food on the way, and Robin sitting across from him, their friendship restored, if not entirely, to what it had been before her honeymoon, then perhaps as close as was possible now that she was married. Mm-hmm. Right now in the sunny beer garden, and in spite of the pain in his leg, his tiredness, and the unresolved mess that was his relationship with Lorelai, life felt simple and hopeful.
Aww. Oh wait, there was a different one that I was thinking of.
What were you thinking of?
In the same garden, where it's from Robin's perspective.
Yeah.
No, here it is, where Robin's thinking about her anniversary trip. It says, it was best not to compare how she felt now to the way she had felt then. And that's the same thing when they're sitting in the beer garden after they interview the Chisels.
Oh,
these two.
That's one of them that starts with a bee buzzing nearby.
Yeah.
And I've always been interested in that because there are a lot of bees mentioned in Lethal White. I don't know if anyone's noticed that.
I have not.
There are a lot of bees, and it's always when Robin is thinking about how she feels about Matthew or Strike.
Bees are basically really little tiny birds. So maybe they're bringing messengers for her emotions.
I was thinking it was like they're buzzing annoying bees, and Matthew's an annoying bee flying around. You gotta swat him away.
He's a wasp. He doesn't pollinate shit. He's not useful. He's horrible.
There is a wasp in Lethal White too, but that one Strike's perspective.
Oh my god.
I've made a list of all of the bees and wasps before because I was really interested in it.
Maybe Robin is still trying to convince herself that Matthew's a bee, but Strike sees him as he is, as a wasp.
There you go.
You'll have to do a whole blog post on it once we get to Lethal White.
Yeah.
We'll have to think about it later when we get to Lethal White, but I've always been interested in that. I thought it was fascinating.
To put interesting. A pin in it.
Anyway, those are great quotes, and yes, definitely parallels, I think.
I think so.
It is interesting to me, though, how, you know, this lightness of heart and this hopefulness is all coming about because Matthew's out of the house, or, you know, he's not going to have to see Lorelai. He's not going to have to see Madeline. You know, it's just like all these other people.
You just want to knock them upside their heads, don't you?
Yes.
Wrapping up his shopping, Strike goes to McDonald's and has a very sad salad. And him resenting the teenagers having the Big Macs just cracks me up and honestly makes me so excited to read him like this in The Running Grave.
I predict he is going to be so grumpy throughout The Running Grave. How is he going to be with no cigarettes, no Big Macs, a lot fewer doom bars, having to eat rabbit food, etc. I mean, how will anybody be able to be around him?
Therapy, my friend. Therapy.
I threw out an idea in our last episode that he's not going to be as grumpy as we expect, just because we expect it.
Yeah, probably.
If there's a little bit of a time jump, we could kind of skip it.
Could skip the worst.
But that would be no fun. I think the grumpy is fun.
I could kind of see maybe like a 6 month thing, so we can get to the progress.
Yeah, so he's adjusted to his new habits.
I'm just throwing out the idea that maybe it might be not what we're expecting. But also this bit with the salad that you pointed out, Kenz, it's so relatable. At first, I kind of laughed because then he buys an apple pie and that defeats the purpose. Mm-hmm. But I know how it is to diet. It can be really hard at first when you don't know what to do. It took me a while to know and understand what to eat to make you feel full, but then also keep calories down. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's not. It's so hard. You have to like do research, understand the mechanism, track your calories.
I'm excited to know already that he's doing well.
Maybe there will be a time skip and we'll get fit, sexy Strike. Not that he's not sexy, but
sexier.
Confident.
I've thought about that possibility. I was thinking about it because I think in a recent episode, we had talked about the possibility of a similar timeline to Ink Black Heart, just a couple months. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of thinking something to contradict what I had said. And that some sort of time jump, such as 6 months, could be realistic if she wants to show some real significant progress. Because weight loss takes a long time.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. It's always quicker for men, though.
It is. But also the other kind of change that I predict he's going to make.
Yeah.
So that would make sense to me, too.
Yeah, it could be it. And it would get to just the point where Robin is boyfriend, girlfriend with Murphy, but she's hesitating to move forward. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. 6 month time skip.
I argued with my own self in my head, and I've convinced myself that I was wrong.
Nice.
So now we'll see.
I love it when I do this.
See.
Now we'll see which one of me is right.
And it's great because either way you win.
Either way, I'm right. I know.
Strike then gets two texts, one from Prudence and one from Shanker. And I have to say that Shanker's text cracks me up. It's short, sweet, and to the point.
There was one time where Joe talked about Shanker and said that he's good in small doses. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
And it's funny because this is the only time we hear from Shanker in this book, but it's so much Shanker into one line that it felt like the perfect amount of him.
Yep, it really did. It was so funny. I think that this text that he sends, irreverent as it is, I think it really does show that Shanker cares about Strike, that he'd check in on him so quickly.
Yeah.
Although now that I say that, I feel like Shanker's going to die.
No.
That'll be when we learn his real name.
At his funeral.
Yeah, at his funeral. Oh. God damn it.
On his gravestone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the juxtaposition here with Joe referring to Shanker's, quote, incurable criminality. But yet that criminal obviously cares very much about Strike's well-being.
Yeah.
And Shanker asking who Strike's pissed off this time makes me think of Shanker's warnings to him in Trouble Blood not to mess with the Reachies and risk pissing them off. Mm-hmm. So I really do love how Shanker and Strike care for each other.
I'm now realizing that Strike never answered that text. I hope Shanker wasn't too worried about him.
Yeah.
I love that Prudence makes a point to reach out to him and doesn't react the same way that Lucy is about to.
Yeah. I feel like Lucy is about to lose a favorite sister contest that she doesn't even know she's entered in.
Yeah. She's about to lose the only sister contest that she's in. Right? I thought the whole I need to lie low might be a touch of a convenient excuse.
Yeah, to me, he hasn't seemed actually reluctant to meet her, not actively avoiding her. But I do wonder if subconsciously, maybe he's not prioritizing it, or maybe he's a little relieved to not have to face it yet.
Yeah, I think that he definitely is. He might be avoiding it slightly, or definitely relieved when stuff comes up.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's growing fond of her, but he's nervous because that's going to be a lot. A
lot of emotions. Yeah, I get that.
Speaking of things being a lot, while Strike was getting ready to respond to Shanker, Lucy calls.
That was an amazing transition there.
Yeah. You know, you're the one who handed it to me. So thank you for the amazing segue. Lucy is just exhausting to read here. Mm. Like, I understand why she's worried, but Jesus, oh my God.
The thing is, I can't say I don't understand this. Both Lucy and Linda react in anger over not being told quickly enough that they're okay. And it's easy to be annoyed at that because we're always on Strike and Robin's side and seeing things from their perspective. But I'm trying to imagine if it were my family member, I think anger is an understandable way to express fear and anxiety. So I get it. I really do. I just wish that Lucy and Linda would stop for a second and think about their approach. I think it's just another example of how well J.K. Rowling writes people.
Yeah, you're so right. If I imagine being on Twitter and seeing that a close loved one's workplace has been bombed and I hadn't heard from them, I would be panicking. And I doubt I'd express my emotions well when I did finally get a hold of them.
Exactly.
But it would be more constructive for their familial relationships if they kind of force themselves to take a deep breath and count to 10 once they find out that they're safe, you know? On the other hand, Carmen and Robin are in danger so much that they really need to work out a system to deal with this. Start in a we've been almost murdered again group chat with all of their family. And you're only allowed to message it. We were almost murdered, but we're good. Talk to you later. Canceling plans tonight.
No curry tonight.
Yeah, that sounds smart.
I agree. I mean, that would be a sensible way to deal with it, because they're going to have to learn, I think, to deal better with the emotions of their family members. I mean, it's not unreasonable for their relatives to be anxious when their loved ones are in such a dangerous line of work. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for Lucy, and I wish Strike would develop more patience with her. She has a very good heart. She just doesn't know how to moderate it to not drive her brother crazy. I think he recognizes this about her, but I guess patience isn't one of his strong points, really. Same thing with Linda. I totally get her anxiety over Robin's work and dislike of Strike because of that. I mean, after all the Ellicotts have been through, maybe Robin will develop more patience and understanding with her mother eventually. And I predict that Linda is going to eventually end up loving Strike.
I mean, how could you not?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, he will be her son-in-law. She's going to have to.
That's right.
I think it might be hard for Strike to be patient with Lucy in these moments because there's a lot of other resentments between them, like Leda. And so that would make it more difficult. I do hope we'll see that relationship smooth out a bit as we go. But I mean, who knows? Maybe she'll always drive him nuts.
That's what family's for, to drive you fucking crazy.
This is
true. That's literally the purpose of siblings, okay? She's doing a great job at it.
Forgetting about responding to Shanker, he checks Twitter and the hashtag fuck Wally Cardew catches his eye.
It's not a bad hashtag.
No.
No, not at
it's
all.
It's succinct. It's clear. It's forceful. It's not particularly creative or catchy, but I think it gets the point across.
Yeah, so. I like it. I think the importance of these tweets is the one at the end where some member of the Brotherhood of Ultima Thule expresses that they'll get revenge for MJ's family's attack on Wally. It just kind of is reinstating their danger and their need for revenge.
Definitely. Although the Brotherhood and the Havening are about to have much more important things to worry about than that, because we got some arrests coming.
So here it says he didn't feel he could stay at Robin's for more than a couple of nights, but equally, he didn't like the idea of leaving her alone in that neat little flat, not until the threat presented by the Havening was eliminated. I kind of like this because I get why he feels like he shouldn't stay more than a couple nights, but also not wanting to leave her alone is very sweet. But the rest of the book with them going around together and staying in hotels and being off investigating was the perfect solution.
Amazing.
Yeah. Although I still can't believe out of all the hotels they stayed at, not a single one had only one room left. I will be mad about that until the end of time.
She sees your trope and she says, fuck your trope.
I know. I know, and I'm mad. Although now that I think about it, really the perfect solution to this would be for Strike to tell Robin he's in love with her and just immediately move in. What better way to keep Robin safe than to live with her? You can even guard her in bed while she sleeps. It's a genius plan.
Someone should really tell Strike how much easier his life would be.
Someone really should.
Comes with a lot of perks.
So many perks. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
All right, let's go to 75. I know we've been waiting for this one.
In this chapter, Strike stays the night with Robin.
I like the way you worded this one. Even better. Getting everyone's hopes up here.
So the epigraph. It gave your curses strength. It warmed your bones the coldest night to feel you were not all alone. Again, the world to fight. And that's The Witch's Last Ride by Emily Pfeiffer.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. I don't really have an interpretation for this except just kill me now with this one already.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so good.
It's Swoon Town. The actual poem is not what I expected, because it's the story of a witch's, you know, imagining her last ride through the night to do all kinds of evil shit before she dies at the end of the poem.
Oh.
Yeah, so I think that Joe must have just thought these lines were just too perfect for Corbin and Robin. And they are. You know, they have each other. They're not alone. What more can you even say to that?
There's no other interpretation other than they're in this together.
Yeah.
These ones that refer to their friendship, even more so even than the ones that refer to their romantic potential, are some of the ones that get me the most.
Definitely.
I just really like this one showing that they're not alone.
They're in this together.
My emotions.
Where'd that emotions closet go?
Yeah, right? I need
We're gonna have to bring it back.
Can I just say before we dive into this chapter, though, that I am so excited we finally got here because this is one of my favorite chapters in the whole book. So good.
I think a lot of people will agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we switch points of view back to Robin, who, in stark contrast to Madeline, is actually considering that Strike might need to eat while he's over and is grabbing some food to cook.
Yeah, weird. We all love this. We all find it funny that Robin gets an entire chicken specifically to feed Strike. But I do really think that this is a deliberate contrast being set up here to show Robin caring about him and his needs when Madeline, not so much.
Yeah, with Madeline, it's all about Madeline. You know, Robin cares about other people and actually thinks about their needs and interests. One of my favorite things are all those perfect, thoughtful gifts she's given to Strike over the years. Yeah. I mean, she really puts a lot of thought into it. I just love that. So yes, the entire chicken is perfect too.
And we know how much those gifts have meant to him for that exact reason, right?
Yeah.
He's always really touched by that. I always think is sweet.
Any moments where he's touched by something that somebody else has done, they're like, oh.
He needs to be touched so by Robin in a different way soon or I'm going to riot.
Amen to that.
Make protest signs.
Yeah.
Robin wonders why Strike chose to stay with her rather than Madeline. And it says, she wouldn't put it past him to have concerns about her safety. He'd sometimes displayed protective instincts that, while occasionally exasperating, had their endearing aspect. If she were entirely honest with herself, she was very shaken by what had happened that morning and glad he was coming to stay. After all, both their names had been written on the bomb, and she felt a need to be with the only person who understood how that felt.
I think she's being really careful with her own thoughts right now. I believe all this is true, but she's not touching on the other thing that I think might make her glad that he's coming over.
Yeah, she's very good at completely missing the elephant in the room, or grizzly bear, you might say.
Yeah,
The bison stampeding through the...
Yes, Robin, please stop ignoring the large, sexy animal in the room. But I do like that she thinks that his protective instincts can be endearing. It's nice to know that she's not always irritated by them, because I think they're endearing too.
Yeah. How could they not be a little bit endearing when they're proof of how much he cares about her and how much he doesn't want to lose her? A little corner of her heart must warm up when he does this, even though it might be very frustrating and annoying. But little butterflies, he cares about me.
I mean, that's why I find it endearing.
Yeah.
I don't personally find it frustrating. I think I'm the opposite in that.
Yeah.
While shopping, Robin takes a call from her mother, and I loved the fact that it specifically points out that she takes the call from her mother for the same reason Strike takes the call from Lucy, to keep things from getting worse.
I feel like there are some similarities between Lucy and Linda in this book especially, and part of me wonders if it's being set up this way as another thing to put them on equal footing. They're both going to be able to understand what it's like to have maybe overly nervous family members and what it's like to have to deal with that. It just feels like something else that's uniting them as a pair.
When Linda asks if Robin wants to come home, this conversation that it sparks between the two of them is interesting, and it's really great to see Robin stand up for herself and what she loves doing. She was exhausted, stressed, and scared. She understood her mother's panic and pain, but she was a grown woman of 30, and she was going to make her own decisions now, no matter who it upset, after long years of doing what other people, her parents, Matthew, wanted her to do. The safe, dull, and expected thing.
I'm really proud of Robin for the way she handles this conversation with Linda, because maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like the first time we've seen her really push back with her mother as much as she is here. There's a little bit of snark when she says, "Aren't you going to ask who was there?" And then the very open and honest response that Robin gives to Linda, saying that no one wants to stop her doing what she loves. And Robin says, you do want to stop me doing it.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure that troubled blood Robin would have said that, because she's always tried to keep the peace. But she didn't do that here. And I think it's a moment of growth for her.
Yeah, I agree. I think Robin is realizing that maybe a little tough love is required here. I mean, it's obviously a balancing act because she needs to stand up for herself and the choices she's made in life. But I know she does understand why Linda is the way she is.
I think the fact that Linda's immediate question to Robin was, do you want to come home? I think it really highlights the fact that Linda hasn't fully accepted or internalized Robin's life as an independent adult to me yet. It gives off the sense that, oh, her life in London isn't really her permanent, her real life. It's home in Yorkshire is where she's going to turn, obviously, when something bad happens, when, you know, that's not the case anymore. Linda's made the same offer before, like in Career of Evil, but I just love the way that Robin deals with it now. Mum, said Robin patiently, I am home. Mm-hmm. Just the perfect way of doing what you said, standing up for herself.
Having said that, that doesn't mean that I don't understand Linda's perspective. It always surprises me how negatively people feel about her because I totally empathize with her, even if I want her to handle her worries differently. Mm-hmm. Something that I was thinking about recently was that when Robin was raped and almost killed, that had to be really traumatic for Linda to almost lose her child in such a horrific way and then watch her struggle to heal.
Yeah.
As a parent, I can't imagine. And I think that every time something happens like this, and it's happened a lot, it must stir that back up in her.
I completely agree with you here. You know, I pride myself on not commenting on or interfering in my grown daughter's life, but I mean, with experiences like what the Ellicotts went through, maybe being more hands-off would be just too hard. I mean, yeah. I can understand her mother's inability to let go and feel like she still needs to protect her child. I mean, she's a woman of 30, but she's still Linda's child, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. But hopefully Linda will be able to eventually grow beyond that. Because, I mean, it's got to be exhausting trying to still mother Robin.
Yeah, and it must be a little different for Linda since her daughter often finds herself in life-threatening situations.
Yeah.
If only someone could tell her that Robin's a fictional character and she's going to be fine.
Don't worry. She's the protagonist. She's totally safe, Linda. You're good. However, watch out for your husband because I'm sensing tragedy.
Nobody told her that Robin is one of the main characters so that she can't die.
But seriously, I wonder if Linda ever got therapy after what happened to Robin. Because if it was me, I don't think I would know how to not freak out every time my kid left the house.
Yeah.
I hope she did.
The whole family should have had it.
Yeah, Lucy could probably benefit from that a bit as well. Mm-hmm. And by a bit, I mean a lot.
Yes. Everyone goes to therapy.
Everyone.
You get a therapy and you get a therapy and you definitely get a therapy.
Yeah. You know what's so funny is that we joke about this all the time. But one of the things that I love so much about these books is that I think that we could all find bits of ourselves in these kinds of moments. And maybe we don't know that we're like this, or maybe we don't know, oh, this is something I could work on, or I deal with this too, or feeling inspired that Robin went to therapy and got over her panic attacks. I just think, I don't know, the way she deals with mental health and stuff in these books has always been one of my favorite things about them.
Yeah,
because I feel like we can all grow from it. Mm. Anyway, on another note about this, Linda asks her why she doesn't join the police. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some people think that this is an actual possibility. And I was wondering what you guys thought about this, because I think there's zero chance of that happening.
Yeah, because I mean, she'd have to start out at the very bottom. Because even with great recommendations from Wardle, she still has to go through the training. She still has to move up the ranks. They're not just going to say, okay, let's hire you today. You're a detective.
Exactly.
It's not how the cops work. So it'd be ages before she could even investigate again. And given how much she loves investigating, how satisfied she is with the freedom and initiative that being a PI gives her, I just don't see it as a move that Robin would ever make, even if it could theoretically be possible.
She wouldn't ever be her own boss again.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
No.
I completely agree with that. Honestly, after all the work that she's put into the agency to get it where it is, I just can't see her ever leaving it. She loves it too much. And also, that just doesn't seem like the sort of story that Joe is trying to tell, however theoretically possible it may be.
Yeah, I think especially too, now that the emphasis has really been made on them being equals with her name on the door, there's just no way.
It would be kind of a smack in the face, especially after that, you know, it's being such like a poignant sort of, yes, both of their names are on the door. They're both equal partners, and then having her leave. Nah, we've got too few books left in the series to try and do some shit like that.
It wouldn't happen.
And the way that Joe talked about that moment too, where she says, you know, showing what they've been through together, and I can't remember her exact words, but you know, I remember her touching her heart when she talked about the door.
My question is, why would Linda think working for the police would be a less dangerous job?
Seriously.
Maybe she gets this impression because having a whole force to work with rather than just one sexy grizzly bear and a bunch of subcontractors would at least provide more resources resources or protection. I don't know. I mean, the work is still just as dangerous, if not more, I think.
Yeah, to me, it seems like it would be a little more dangerous. I mean, it's not like they're getting into super dangerous situations every single day as a PI. Most of what we've seen from these books involves spying on people's cheating spouses and is pretty low risk compared to being a cop.
I wonder if being a police officer here in the U.S. is more dangerous because, well, we know, we all know why.
Yeah.
But I have to imagine that you're both right and that you would find yourself in more frequent dangerous situations.
Yeah.
Both of these conversations with both Lucy and Linda feel like parallels to each other and to me feel equally emotionally exhausting.
I love that Robin and Strike are really in the exact same mindset in these moments because they both just want to be with the only person who understands each other.
That just goes back to the epigraph for me too.
Yeah.
With the weight of her conversation with her mother on her mind, along with what just happened at the office, it's no wonder that the prospect of Strike is the only thing cheering Robin up as she heads towards home with her groceries.
You know, the prospect of Strike, you know, cheers me up a bit too.
Cheers me up wonderfully. Yeah. Super.
We're getting
up.
A new book in a couple months.
I'm cheered.
Very cheered up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the thing that I hope Lucy and Linda can hopefully grow to understand is their approach. Like I said, I understand their worry, but to start this fight at this time for both Strike and Robin when they're scared and in shock is not the way to go.
Agreed. There needs to be more patience from Strike and Robin, but the others really need to get a grip. And I liked your idea of therapy. These folks could use some.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This spirit of defiance against Linda that Robin has as she logs back into Drek's game to check on Anemy is really excellent.
Yeah, it's so real. I mean, it's just another example of Jo's brilliance with infusing her characters with true human nature.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
I was going to say, who among us has not felt that way towards her mother? You know?
When it says that Strike atypically arrived exactly when he said he would, does that mean that he must have slipped up a few times when it comes to showing up to stuff on time? Or is Jo maybe retconning the fact that Strike started making an effort to be on time after she yelled at him for it in Troubled Blood or something different? Because I know we made a point of saying after Robin said you need to stop being late to stuff, he started showing up on time for stuff after that.
Maybe she forgot.
Yeah, I guess that's possible.
I wouldn't expect him to be on time all the time. So it's possible that it still doesn't always happen. But I think what it really is a reminder to the reader of the previous grievances that Robin had, though.
Makes sense.
I'm going to be the romantic here and say that he's tonight just especially eager to get to Robin's.
Oh,
thus
yeah.
The punctuality.
I also take that stance. I'm on board with that.
Yeah, I think we're all with you there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
There's a line that talks about how Robin notices his expression and that she knows it means he's in pain. I kind of like these little ways that show how well these two know each other.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Robin in particular is always very aware of Strike and how his mood is and what it means. She's like a mother who could tell like their baby's cries, what different cries mean, but she does it with Strike. Oh, that face means he's hungry. That face means he's in pain.
I need to feed him first.
Yeah.
I think it will be interesting to see how Robin deals with his grumpiness that I'm predicting for the running grave. It'll have to be over the top with all that he's giving up, but we'll see.
I'm interested to see how she's going to deal with his jealousy. That's what I'm most interested in.
Strike is able to get a view of Robin's flat all furnished for the first time since he helped her moved in. And I really love getting the descriptions of the art prints and stuff that she has. It's just a really nice little glimpse into Robin's personality.
I really like seeing these things. And I like that Strike seems to like learning little things about her, new little things.
Me too. Lindsay, don't you have the two prints that it talks about in this chapter?
I do. I got them on Etsy shortly after the book came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have an Arsenal keychain. I have the artwork that Robin has.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of us also have the Narciso perfume.
Yeah, and I have a bunch of empty Doom Bar bottles on my shelf.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice, nice. You nerds. Nah, I have Narciso, it's lovely. But going back to the paintings, they're such interesting choices for her character, I feel like, looking at both of these, because they feel very cheerful with all kinds of saturated colors. And reading into the Fauvist movement, it valued simplified forms, but also the individual expression of the artist above all. And I feel like that emphasis on self-expression that these painters embodied might appeal to Robin, who spent so long repressing herself.
Yeah, I think it also shows that she's finally coming into herself as a full-fledged adult. This is great artwork. It's not Destiny's Child's poster on her wall.
Yeah. I wonder if these are new, if she just recently bought them. Because that would be interesting to know, you know, is she buying them as her new self-expression in her new place?
I bet she did.
The fact that they're mentioned, you know, I mean, we haven't heard about anything like this before. So I think a point's being made.
I don't think Matthew would like having nice, cheerful art.
You know, I was telling you, I was watching Titanic the other day. Mm-hmm. There's a part where Rose is looking at the artwork that she has in their suite, and she's talking about how great it is, and her fiance is talking about how ugly they are, and he doesn't really appreciate them. I got such strong, like, Robin and Matthew vibes from that.
What's that guy's name? Cal?
Cal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cal Hockley.
I thought you were going to go for something that Robin would strike to draw her.
Like one of his French girls.
No, it's going to be the other way around because Robin is the one who can draw.
Oh, good Lord. Okay. So they start to talk about Ormond, but Strike asking Robin whether beer or wine have more calories, and it just stopping her dead in her tracks kills me in the best way when she's like, calories? You?
You?
I love that she was going to tease him about this, but then decided not to. It's funny, but also it's very sweet.
Yeah, it is. And I'm sure she'll have many opportunities for some gentle teasing in the future about this. But for now, she's just being supportive.
I hope there are teasing opportunities. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Lots please. Of them. I also like that he tells her what's wrong.
Yes. I like it not just because it's an example of him being honest and open with her as like a person and a best friend, but also because he's letting his partner know that he's taking action on this issue that's been affecting their work together, and he's really clear about it, so she knows that he's trying.
Yeah, and we get a similar moment in just a bit where she sees that he bought an e-cigarette.
Yeah.
I love the line that says she had assumed Strike would die with a Benson and Hedges clamped between his teeth.
There's a better not be foreshadowing for relapse and shocking death.
No, it's just a hilarious line.
Yes. Yeah.
I have to say, I'm eagerly awaiting more of Robin being pleasantly surprised by changes in Strike's behavior in the future.
How many more days?
Right?
Where are we at? 93, according to my countdown on my phone. I also really love when Robin tells Strike that she just put dinner in the oven, and he says that she didn't have to cook. They could have gotten takeout. That whole exchange is nice because I think her cooking for him means a lot more to him than we're getting to see here.
Yeah, I think so too. Honestly, cooking for someone is basically a love language in its own right. It's a powerful statement of caring when someone makes an effort to feed the person they love.
I agree. And now I think that Joe is legally obligated to have Strike cook for Robin at some point.
Legally, yes.
Yeah.
Poor Robin.
Oh, I bet he can cook. Remember, he made curry for Ted and Joan.
Mm-hmm. He can do stir fries.
Okay.
It won't be particularly healthy, but that's fine. Everybody's entitled to some cheat days. It's fine.
Well, maybe he's learning. You know, we know he's successful at his diet, so maybe he's learning. And
he gets to have cake. He's learning about moderation.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for this book. Okay. Their conversation about Philip Ormond getting arrested is very interesting. And it's very helpful to the reader because Strike reviews some of the things that happened in Ormond's interview way back when. I think the most important takeaway here is that Strike is 100% right in his assessment that Ormond came face to masked face with Anime. And that's why Ormond made the gesture about a mask and why he made the comment of Anime trying to pin it on him.
It just looks so much worse for Ormond. Mm-hmm. Hiding the phone and trying to get into it rather than just coming forward immediately to the cops.
Idiot.
You made it so much worse for yourself.
So stupid.
Oh, well, the arrest couldn't have happened to a more deserving shithead.
Sweet, sweet karma.
Do we know what age he teaches? Because if they're old enough, these rumors are going to haunt his career for years.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers are going to keep that going.
Yeah, I don't know if we do know, but I hope.
I hope so too.
Yeah.
Old enough for detention.
Yeah.
It really made me laugh at how casually and smoothly Strike says, "So what else were you doing last night? You said you were working." I just think he's so cute there. It's so cute.
It's adorable. And he really did slip it in the second he got an opportunity.
Uh-huh.
A literal bomb going off couldn't make him forget that maybe Robin was up to something and he's got to find out what, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't say anything about his feelings when she tells him what she was actually up to, but you have to think that he was so relieved.
Definitely. You could hear the internal thank fuck from across the pond.
Yeah. Also, I just have to say that Robin killed it the night before. Not only did she get good stuff out of Pez, but the unplanned stuff of following her instinct about Zoe paid off in such a huge way. She figured out that Tim Ashcroft is, in fact, a pedophile.
Good for her.
Yeah.
They should start a side gig, pedo hunters. Make it a whole branch of their agency where they just hunt down pedos and get the proof to lock them away or, you know, take direct action. Chop, chop.
Can the pedo hunters have a jingle like Grave Digging Buddies?
Oh, jingle. Yeah. I feel like it's going to be like, na, 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 pedo hunters. Na, 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 cutting dicks off left and right. Yeah.
Tips and jingles.
That gives a whole new meaning to tips and jingles.
Oh my God, it does.
As a side note, I didn't know that they called them pedos, by the way.
Oh, they call them...
No, I know. I learned that, I don't know when, somewhat recently. But we don't say it the same way. And we don't have like a shorter name for it, I don't think.
Well, I think we've said peds.
Really? I've never heard it.
Yeah, we've used that before.
They say pedophile.
Yeah.
Which I know from that episode of the IT Crowd where she has a boyfriend whose name is Peter File. And she realized that it sounds like pedophile and then she can't date him anymore. Because he's like, it's me. I'm pedophile running through the airport.
Oh, God.
At this point, Robin hand-striked the printouts of what she had been researching all night on social media. And it's all the tweets from Tim Ashcroft the pedophile hitting on all these young girls and asking their age. Every time I read this, it shocks me at how bad he is at hiding it.
So bad.
He's not subtle. And we know from Rachel later that the pen of justice hitting on young girls is, it's a fandom in-joke. Like, you're not a real incart till pen tries to get into your pants. From this evidence, it looks like Ashcroft is also doing this just as much under his own name. So, yeah. One, how had no one in the fandom connected that these two were the same person before? And two, how has he not been caught? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, he's just one word. I mean, he is gross.
Gross.
What would be a strike fandom inside joke?
You're not a real striker until insults you personally.
Yeah, that's a good one. In all of these tweets, I think it's worth pointing out that there's one from Darcy Barrett, who is the young woman who Gus was pretending to date and posted awful things about on Reddit. Mm-hmm. She says, "Me too, it's shit," about wrapping presents. And then Lapine's disciple, Gus, responds, "Take shit to no shit." It's not some huge clue, but I love how thoroughly this world has been created where these seemingly random tweets match up with the bigger story.
Yeah, I mean, that is really neat. But also, it seems like a huge coincidence to me, Darcy turning up on this Twitter thread. Huh. So was she a fan of Ink Black Heart as well?
Maybe.
I guess it's just a small internet.
After all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's just a book thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's convenient to show, to plant it there.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting that the Pen of Justice account calls Lapine's disciple an incel, which we know is Gus. So, and this is the only time in the book that that word is used, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really.
When Robin comes back into the room and asks Strike if he'd finished reading it all, I love how immediately they're on the same page.
I love that his expression is forbidding. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, his whole reaction to this is perfect. Being upset that Ashcroft is going to schools and muttering about how he fucking hates pedophiles. This is the response I like to see. Number one quality in a man. Hates pedophiles. Like, it's the bare minimum, but it's good. I like to see it.
When I was reading this, I was thinking back to Career of Evil. You know, when Robin defies Strike to try to help save Alyssa's daughter from the pedophile Brockbank. And in that book, Strike seemed a lot more nonchalant about this sort of thing. Not that he wouldn't hate it, but just, you know, understandably to an extent, when it's your job, you've got to somehow be able to deal with it dispassionately. But here it's cool that he's actually passionate about it. And I'm just wondering, you know, has Robin rubbed off on him in this regard?
This actually got me thinking about something that's going to come up in the next chapter when they argue over safety and their plans. And we can talk about it more, but I think it's possible that Strike has, of course, always hated pedophiles, but in Career of Evil, we see Robin having a much stronger reaction to it, maybe because of her own past trauma with sexual assault. And in the next chapter where Strike snaps, it makes sense to me that we're seeing his response to his own past trauma of being in an explosion.
Yeah. That makes sense to me.
I really like this next part when they're discussing Tim Ashcroft the pedophile, and Strike says that this explains why your friend Pez was having a go at him at the funeral, because Robin gets upset at this. There had been an undertone in Strike's voice she hadn't much appreciated. He raised his eyebrows, a slight smirk on his face, and Robin, to her own irritation, felt herself turning pink. I just like this part. How do you guys feel about this? Because I think that Robin is actually overreacting just a bit because she feels a little defensive, but I don't think that he meant it how she's taking it.
Yeah.
No, I agree that she seems to be feeling a little self-conscious about it and a little defensive. Yeah, because she overreacts. Strike is right later when he says he'd have said much worse if it had been Barkley. And Strike and Robin often tease each other, right? It's banter. He just hit on a little bit of a sensitive spot without realizing it here.
If only she knew he was asking because he's so jealous.
Oh, I would love to. I want her to know that.
I think it's actually sweet. His attempt at teasing her was also an attempt to find out how much she liked kissing Pez, you know?
Yeah.
He probably was hoping that she would have said something like, oh, he was awful, or that was terrible, or something.
I guess I'll have to settle for I did what I had to do, which is not too bad. It was all business. It was business kissing.
Can that be a thing they start at the office, but only between the partners?
Yes.
Okay, so now Madeline calls and the real fun for me begins. I know people can hate this part.
So cringy.
I really like it. My favorite bit is Robin realizing exactly what's going on and looking at him with accusatory eyes. And then also Madeline knowing what's going on too. It's so funny.
I'm living for it. I absolutely love it when Strike closes his eyes as if he were a child on an out of control bike careering towards a wall. Because one, the imagery is absolutely hilarious.
Strike on a bike.
Yeah, and what an appropriate metaphor to his approach to relationships so far. He's along for the ride, and then it crashes spectacularly.
Yeah, it's really good. You know, he wouldn't have these problems if he stopped trying to date women who aren't Robin.
From your mouth to his ears.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I wish I could share y'all's positivity about this, because like the room service line just makes me cringe, and honestly just makes a bit of my soul just die from secondhand embarrassment. Ugh.
Are you feeling it for Strike or for Robin?
For Strike. When she says, I'm not stupid, Coram, and he just continues to lie. It's like, oh, dude.
Well, he did it.
It's so dumb. I hate that he does this right here. It just kills me.
We have to talk about the line that says, sweet, said Madeline coldly. It's like you're married, isn't it?
Sipping my tea.
Yeah, I have a note in my ebook that says, this is exactly like they're married. I really hope that going forward, instead of Strike thinking, how could it work like he normally does, that he'll think back on this night of having dinner and washing up together, all while talking about the case and realizing that this is exactly how life with Robin would be, and it would be perfect.
Oh, I really hope we do get that in the running grave.
I mean, I feel like it's being set up a bit.
So goddamn cute. Okay.
Cools, I want to point something out that you said a while back. I can't remember when you said it, but it stuck with me because I thought it was such a good observation. Strike is thinking to himself that it has to end with Madeline, and he ends his thoughts with apologize. But what you pointed out is that he goes directly to Robin and apologizes. And I just love that.
Yeah, it's Robin's feelings that are his utmost concern. She's the one he wants to fix things with. Honest to God, it makes me want to go scream into my pillow.
Yeah, it's so good. And I think his apology is sweet, although it's funny and telling to me that he's apologizing about teasing her about Pez and not that he just called her room service to Madeline. But I think he got that right, because that's what Robin is really upset about. I don't think she's angry about Strike lying about her to Madeline at all, because all it says is that she was very interested in this information, kept stirring the gravy, hoping to hear more, but not wanting to ask for it. I think that not only is she intrigued about why he lied about her and what it means, but also I think she gets it, because she did the same thing when she was married to Matthew. I think that's why I don't find this as awkward or cringy as you do, Ken's, because I think Robin totally gets it and it immediately lessens the awkwardness for me.
Yeah, agreed. I don't see Robin as being judgy at all here about what's going on between Strike and Madeline. Although I find it interesting that he tells her it's Madeline because, quote, he had no energy left for lying. So does this mean he would have lied to Robin had he had the energy? And who would he have said it was instead? And how could that have mattered?
I think the reason he might have lied to Robin is to hide the fact that she's clearly a source of jealousy for Madeline. So he could have said, oh, it's Lucy. I told her I was going to a hotel. I don't want her to, you know, be like, why didn't you come to my place or something?
That's true.
But yeah, I think that's specifically why he might have lied about it to Robin.
Yeah.
Going back to his apology over Pez, though, like you mentioned just a bit before, Pools, I did like his explanation that him teasing her was just banter. It's what they do. And that it would have been worse if it was Barkley. I have to believe that.
Yes, I wish I was funny enough to come up with something that he'd say to Barkley. These two, you know, Sherlock Big Cock and the Tartan 12-inch, I assume that whatever banter they would do, it would not be safe for work.
Definitely not.
Even though they're at work.
Yeah, but I was just thinking, you know, it's so sweet that Carmen and Barkley's banter is so generous and complimentary to each other with those nicknames. They're really just lifting each other up. It is heartwarming.
You have a big dick. No, you have a big dick.
No, you have the biggest dick. It's so cute.
Oh my God. Sweet. Oh, the jokes these two would have come up with if they were the ones at North Grove.
God, can you imagine?
I also think it's so funny that after discussing why Pez fits the anime profile so well, and Robin saying that she just doesn't feel it, it says, by exercising heroic self-restraint, Strike refrained from making the most obvious of the ribald comments that occurred to him.
I wouldn't have been able to stop myself. I genuinely would not have been able to keep a straight face. So I feel like Strike deserves a hell of a lot of brownie points for this.
Heroic self-restraint.
It is heroic.
Do you think the fact that Strike is tempted to make a sexual joke with Robin means that we can expect a bit more of that coming up? Please. Have they ever done this before?
I don't know if they have, but I want more of it.
Me too.
All definitely. Of
it. Yeah. Add it into that flirting that we mentioned.
They decide to go interview Inigo Epcot the next morning together. And I just love how it says that Robin had no objection to spending the morning with him. It's one of those moments where I think her feelings for him are shining through a bit. And it's very cute.
It's adorable. And I love how much she's clearly understating it to herself. Like, no real complaints. Yeah. Oh, please. Try. You're happy. You're thrilled. You're super looking forward to it. You got little butterflies. Come on, Robin.
I know.
But another hilarious moment of diet comedy here is his wearing Strike is confused by the concept of steaming vegetables. I never heard of it. That made me laugh.
Let's talk about this paragraph where Strike is looking around and basically wondering what more he can learn about Robin. It's so sweet. Almost everything is highlighting compatibility.
It really is. And also that her favorite color is blue, I think.
Where does it?
Well, no, it's just everything is blue. Okay. She put a blue pot for the philodendron. Her curtains are blue.
Yeah.
Might interesting. Two instances, but she clearly. Okay. Never mind.
I like it. I just didn't remember.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of blue in her apartment. And I feel like it's just a color she's really attracted to.
There's some more blue in there now.
Yeah, there's a big blue in there now. Can that be his nickname, Big Blue? That's really cute. I know it might be too close to Bluey, but anyway. I love that he notes all the works on criminology on her bookcase because she's as obsessed with the job as he is.
I also want to know what other novels that Robin enjoys reading alongside all of those books on criminology.
I do too. You know, it would be one of those things in the fandom where we all go out and buy the books that Robin has.
Of course.
So many of us have Narciso and Heartleaf Philodendrons now. We would totally have the books that Robin has.
Totally would. Yeah.
I would push aside my empty Doom Bar bottles and make room for those books.
Add it to the list of another question. Yeah. For Joe. When did Robin buy the artwork and what are her books?
I still need to get a copy of the textbook, the investigative interviewing or whatever that she's reading in one of the, I feel like it was Silkworm or Career of Evil or something.
I think it was Career of Evil.
Yeah.
I also like that he saw with some pleasure that the plant he bought her was on the shelf and looking healthy.
No, his reaction to seeing that is so cute.
You know how it says something like she watered plants too?
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of when Robin thinks about Lorelai and she bakes too.
She bakes.
He's thinking, Robin's so perfect in every way and she waters plants too. And then he looks at all the photos that are on her bookshelf and he ends with the one that has Hugh Jacks in it. I know it's a tiny detail, but can we please see Robin replace that photo at some point? I know it was a fun trip full of other people she likes, but I would not want a picture of that dude in my house.
No, she needs to replace it with a picture of her and Strike together.
Or she can just cut out a little picture of Strike and glue it on top of Hugh Jacks. Retcon history. It was always Strike on the trip with her.
I would like a picture of the two of them to replace it.
Oh.
I feel like Strike would be a little bit freaked out by how much he'd like seeing a picture of the two of them on her bookshelf.
Oh, that would be so sweet.
I don't think Robin would put a photo that includes Hugh Jacks on her mantle. I just found that kind of hard to believe. But
maybe that was before he called her a bitch and she just hasn't gotten around to scratching over his face yet.
I would freaking cut him out of the picture.
I would too. So after they have their adorable dinner and do their little coupley washing up, they... says that they retired to their respective beds shortly afterwards, and if both were aware of the intimacy of Robin handing Strike his own clean bath towel on a pile of clean bedding, and of using the same bathroom, each hid it beneath a matter-of-factness bordering on brusqueness. I remember my first read-through, I was really, really hoping that something would happen between them this evening, but so then I got to their respective beds, and I was like, God damn it.
Like I was saying earlier, she sees those tropes. And she throws them out the window.
Yeah.
I was talking to Anna Kira about this morning, and she pointed out that we know Shark must have needed a shower after being in an explosion, right? She gives him towels. So did he wake up early and take a shower, or did we miss hearing about him taking a shower? You have to assume that he had thoughts like, I'm taking a shower at Robin's house.
Yeah. And that she had thoughts like,
you know what I mean?
Yep, I know what you mean.
I'm thinking about it.
We're all thinking about it.
I love this line where Robin finds Strike snoring comforting, even though he was rumbling like a tractor.
And her uncle has a farm. She knows what tractors sound like. It's got to be an accurate comparison, right?
Oh my God, it's like, and on that farm, she had a Strike. With a snore snore here and a snore snore there.
Oh, that's so cute.
Next, it says, her last conscious thought before drifting off to sleep herself was of Ryan Murphy. Even though a date with him hadn't yet happened and might never happen, the possibility had somehow redressed an imbalance between her and Strike. She was no longer a lovesick fool committed to celibacy in the hope that Strike might one day want what he so clearly didn't want.
Aww.
I remember when I listened to the Epigraph episode, something Beatrice Grove said stood out to me, that Robin doesn't actually have to date this guy to feel that she's redressed that imbalance. It's just the possibility that did it. Of course, I think that it is going to happen, but the distinction is important, I think.
It definitely is. And it goes back to what you were saying last time about just the feeling of confidence being what she needs, not any actual experience lacking.
Yeah, exactly. And then this part, that she was no longer a lovesick fool committed to celibacy in the hope that Strike might one day want what he so clearly didn't, is really telling. Because first of all, you are still lovesick, Robin. Let's get that out of the way.
She caught the love bug in a big way. Yeah.
But committed to celibacy, this kind of goes with what I was thinking in our last episode, that I think Robin has shut herself off from dating opportunities because there's that part of her hoping for more with Strike.
Yeah, that seems plausible to me. She's framing this as what she has been doing. So yeah. Deliberately not seeking out relationships, closing herself off. That's her own acknowledged behavior.
And lastly, when she thinks that he so clearly didn't want a relationship with her, it breaks my heart a little bit.
Yeah.
I hate that she's hurting and thinking he doesn't want this, but I cannot wait for her to learn that he does. It's going to be such a good payoff.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, I agree. Committed to celibacy definitely shows as a conscious effort on Robin's part. And since she's so certain it's not what Strike wants, I wonder if she's going to try really hard to make a relationship with Ryan Murphy work. I mean, of course, we know it won't ultimately, but that would certainly allow for more burn time.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking is going to happen too. It makes me think of the epigraph to chapter 30 where it says, but if I can cheat my heart with the old comfort that love can be forgotten, is it not better? And then just kind of thinking that this concept might carry over well on through Running Brave.
Yeah. It also reminds me of what J.K. Rowling said on Twitter, that Robin is telling herself she shouldn't be feeling what she feels for him. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Next, so we get a dream that we get to talk about. Robin has a dream. Soon she'd sunk into a dream world where she was once again on the verge of marrying Matthew, who was explaining to her in the vestibule of the church, as to a child, that if she'd only asked him, he could have told her who Annamy was, and that her failure to see what was so patently obvious to everyone else proved she wasn't fit for the job that had so nearly separated them forever.
Oh, Matthew, I've missed you.
Even Dream Matthew is annoying.
Even Dream Matthew's an asshole.
I have not missed him at all.
No. I know some people are worried about being on the verge of marriage again, and that she was thinking about Murphy. I don't really think it's going to get that far. I can't see us repeating the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
I'd be surprised. I think it's just maybe that it's the wrong guy again.
Yeah, please no to that repeating the same storyline.
Yeah, I don't think it means another marriage. I think that psychologically, the stress of the day, her conversation with Linda, combined with thoughts of dating equals Matthew showing up in her head being a dick. But maybe it expresses a subconscious worry about whether or not the man she dates, Murphy, will respect her career.
I'm wondering if Ryan Murphy in the next book might end up following the same formula that Madeline has, where she's kind of a combination of Robin and Charlotte. But in this case, it would be a combination of Strike and Matthew.
That's interesting, Ken. And in this scenario, if the bits of Matthew turn out to be jealousy, I don't know if I can really blame him.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be some reason there.
I read the dream sequence as just being Robin's own misgivings about herself and her lack of confidence in her own abilities as a detective and as an adult, even. Matthew is mansplaining to her, quote, as a child, that she's failing in her profession and in love. Oh. And that day, Linda treating her like a child and diminishing her career. And Robin feels like a failure in love since she thinks Strike isn't interested in her.
Yeah. It's really been one roller coaster of a day, hasn't it?
It really has been. This time yesterday, her tongue was in Pierce's mouth or whatever. Tongue and her tongues were involved.
Yeah.
You know.
As a bit of a side note, I want to point out that marriage is mentioned twice in this chapter. Once where Madeline says it, and then now with this dream. I fully want to believe that this was intentional because this chapter is exactly what marriage would be like for them. Well, not exactly. It would be much better, but you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. This is that little window, the crystal ball, looking into what domesticity between them would look like. Combined with those two mentions of marriage, it's suggestive. I don't think you're wrong. I think you're right.
Thank you. Speaking of marriage, just to talk about it because it's fun.
Sure. Let's hear your monologue on marriage because I'm intrigued. Is that good?
I don't know.
No, I love listening. I love listening to this. It's heartwarming. It sends me right to the emotions closet.
Okay.
Do not pass the angry dome. Okay. Do not collect $200.
Okay. I know that since Ink Black Heart, there's been more debate in the fandom about how far we'll see their relationship get. But I'm still of the belief that there's so much foreshadowing for marriage in these books for these two. It's actually been a theory of mine for a long time that we'll get an epilogue in the final book with their wedding. That feels like a very J.K. Rowling series epilogue to me.
You know, what warms my heart the most and gives me the most confidence that they'll end up together is the swan imagery.
Swans.
You know, I love the swans. Yeah.
We love the swans.
Swans.
Yeah.
I just hearken back to that. Anytime I doubt, I think, no, the swans.
But starting back with chapter one of Cuckoo's Calling, when Robin thinks that Matthew's proposal was the most perfect proposal in the history of matrimony, contrasted with her thoughts in Lethal White, where she wonders what it would be like to have a wedding day and honeymoon that was safe to think back on. That was a moment in Lethal White that stopped me in my tracks when I first read it, because I believed I knew what that meant back in 2018, and I still believe it now.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the fact that she looked into his eyes to say I do is a big one. But also from Strike's perspective and how often he thinks of marriage, even if he's thinking that he's not the marrying type, he still thinks about it a lot.
A lot.
The way he thinks about Robin goes from she's the type of woman who wants to get married to she's the type of woman who men wanted to marry. And to me, that shift in the way he thinks about it is significant because at first he's separating himself from it. We could never work because she's the type to get married and I'm not. But now after his Mazenkoff and Krupov thing at the end of Trouble Blood, his thoughts don't seem to rule himself out as one of those men anymore.
Yeah, it's shifted to some other bastard's gonna marry her first, not exactly. On my watch.
Yeah.
Literal exact quote there, by the way.
I mean, I know I could be wrong, but I think there's just so much talk about marriage and foreshadowing that hints towards it that I really believe that that's where we're headed. And I like seeing these two little mentions of marriage in this particular chapter.
Yeah, me too.
That delivered exactly what I was hoping for from the marriage talk. So thank you. Thank you, Lindsay.
There are literally no two people in this world who are more destined to be husband and wife than these two.
It's almost like she's writing it, you know.
On purpose that way?
Yeah.
Amazing.
They'll be the cutest.
Oh my God. They will be unbearably cute. Ken's, this email that you just sent us about Ryan rubbing his nose being an indication that he's lying about the facts and dates. Mind blown.
Dun,
I'm losing my mind.
What?
Sorry, Ken's just sent a screenshot. It suggests, because Paul, you might want to hear this. Yeah. Do you think the fact that Ryan rubs his nose while making his confession about being an alcoholic indicates that he might be lying about some of the facts surrounding
Does it say that he rubbed his nose?
Yeah, because the epigraph says being concise in facts and dates. So maybe he's not, he's lying, because Grant Ledwell brushes his nose while telling Strike about his phone call with Edie, which is a lie. It's a tell.
That's interesting.
I'm intrigued by this theory that maybe he's not being honest about the timeline of his sobriety here.
Oh, okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I just saw that and I'm like, my mind is blown.
I like that.
I like it too.
Who sent that to us? Joanne, not that Joanne, but a Joanne.
Nice. I'm intrigued.
Okay. Chapter 76.
So in chapter 76, Strike and Robin drive to the Epcots.
So the epigraph reads, "What inn is this where for the night peculiar traveler comes?" That is from, it's stated to be 34 by Emily Dickinson, but is actually 115 by Emily Dickinson.
This is an epigraph that I remembered reading and understanding that Strike and Robin were about to go off and stay somewhere overnight before I read the chapter. It made me really excited.
Yep. It makes me laugh because the speaker in this poem is complaining about this inn. He's like, no fire in the hearth, no beer in my mug, no one to carry imaginary luggage, no lift
for
to the attic.
Shame.
Yeah, for a shame. It's so funny.
It's funny.
And I think there's like some metaphor here with this inn about life and death, but I can't quite get a grasp on it, so I'm going to ignore it.
Okay.
But yeah, our travelers, not peculiar one, it's a bit rude of the poem to call them that, are headed afield and will need an inn for the night.
That's funny. I wonder if Joe read the poem and thought, that's very Strike to complain about.
Yeah, it is.
I like that. Maybe it's the circumstances that are peculiar.
Oh, yeah, Robin. Well, getting bombed out by neo-Nazis is a bit peculiar, I guess.
It is, yeah. The chapter opens up by telling us about Strike and Robin's morning. I like the little mention that they ate breakfast at the table where they'd eaten dinner. Yeah. I know it's probably a reach, and I'm finding cuteness in things that aren't meant to be cute, but reminding us that they'd also eaten dinner at that table feels, again, very domestic, and a reminder to me that this is what life would be like, will be like for them when they finally get there.
Well, I think when they finally get there, they're going to be having some breakfast in bed, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, I thought you were about to say they'd use the table for other things as well.
Well, and that, so it's both flipped. Breakfast in bed, bed on the table, you know, activities.
There's a lot to talk about in this next bit. Nutley sends a text resigning because his wife doesn't want him working for them now that they have a terrorist group after them and that they've been sent a bomb. As much as we joke about Nutley and as obnoxious as I find him, I actually don't think there's anything wrong with this. In the real world, this would 100% be my reaction if my husband was working for them or if I was a recently hired subcontractor. I think that Strike and Robin, and even Barkley, because he's been there for so long, it's more than a job to them. You know, they're a team, a work family, but I don't blame Nutley or his wife at all for this.
You make a good point. Yeah. I also think that all of the rest of them have this strong sense of, I don't know what to call it, the emotion where they'd be all like, hell no, I'm not going to let these Nazis scare me. Fuck these Nazis. I'm going to work even harder now.
I think that stubbornness is what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Yes. Well, it might not be the most sensible reaction, but I relate to it. shockingly.
I will even say that I think that their responses to him are unfair. It seems to me like they're responding out of anger that they're down another person and that he doesn't share the sense of loyalty that they all have to each other. But why would he?
I mean, he has been fired once before.
He has.
But then so has Robin. So I don't know where I'm going with this.
How long has he been there? Why would he have the same sense of loyalty? And even to his wife.
Yeah.
He's just not devoted.
I get the wife.
Yeah.
Well, my concern about Nutley, really, who the hell else is going to hire him? I doubt that he's got people clamoring at his door. I'm concerned for his wife's sake.
Okay.
Well, we haven't met her. She could be lovely and just made a huge mistake.
Maybe she finds him charming, or maybe she's equally as annoying.
She could be equally as annoying.
Either way, I don't think being sent a bomb and leaving a job because of it is a necessarily bad thing. I think that we're all kind
Yeah.
of looking at that from Strike and Robin's perspectives.
And what we know is Nutley.
Yeah. We
Yeah.
already don't like Nutley.
We all know he's a jerk.
So it's really funny when Barkley calls him like a cowardly fucking whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we already don't like him. Sure. So we're like, yeah, fuck that
Exactly.
guy. Don't let the door hit you on the way out, Nutley. Nutsack.
Nutsack. Oh my gosh. God.
Best nickname ever.
But because of this text from Nutley, Shrike and Robin get into an argument because he snaps at her when she suggests splitting up and dividing the work. I tend to agree with Shrike in these things that sticking together is best or staying at a hotel is best or whatever. And I think that's why I sometimes feel a slight frustration with Robin in these moments because I've always felt that part of her desire to get back out there, even when it's not the best choice, I think that it comes from that fight in her to not let the bad things that happen hold her back like it had once before when she was stuck in her bedroom. And while I think that that's brave, it doesn't mean that I think it's always the best choice. So I understand how it could be frustrating for Shrike because I too have felt that frustration at times.
Realistically, in this scenario, I mean, having both of them there while they get bombed isn't going to be much safer than just one of them getting bombed. I just don't know how much real risk there is in them each doing surveillance alone, as opposed to.
I think that he's not necessarily worried about a bomb specifically, but that they're
Yeah.
going to attack them. And it's going back to the
Yeah.
thing that he said in Lethal White, that he worries about her more because if she comes up against a grown man, she is at a disadvantage.
It is true.
It is
Yeah.
true. And I love that he recognizes that and wants to stick with
Yes.
her so that they're
Okay.
better off together.
I like that. And it does lead to them going off on a
Yeah.
little investigative vacation at the
Yeah.
seaside.
What I would like to see in the future is Robin understanding that just because he's pushing for being extra safe or cautious does not mean that he's questioning her abilities or thinking she's an airhead, like she says here, because I don't believe that that's how he feels.
No, he doesn't. We know he respects her.
Yeah. I think maybe she's making assumptions because that's what Matthew would have said or thought, or maybe she thinks that's what her mother thinks. They still got to work on that whole talking thing.
Yeah, it's the ingrained defensiveness because of the other people in her life. Like Strike's reactions are sometimes colored by his past with Charlotte. It's the same thing.
I just love how this exchange really winds him up, and it makes him, quote, unwarrantedly aggressive and drove him to, quote, smoke two cigarettes back to back.
He goes from 0 to 100 so fast. It's like he was here and now he's up here.
I think that points to what we've been talking about, that maybe there is some PTSD stirring up in him that neither of them are really acknowledging, because it makes the snapping more understandable to me because I have a tendency to become more easily frustrated when stressed or anxious. My husband's listening to this like,
He's sipping the tea.
Yeah, let's add another therapy addition to this.
Yeah, I start crying really easily.
Yeah, maybe he needs to work on his approach, but I guess when they're able to be more honest with each other, I think this will get easier.
Yeah.
Can we talk about Robin's thoughts on the way to the Epcots? Because she's angry at Strike,
Yeah.
and it cracks me up that she wonders if he was fake snoring in order to text Madeline without her knowing. I can't imagine why on earth he would do that. It really makes me laugh. Even if he was texting Madeline, imagine a person fake snoring. I can't.
He's under the
Honestly, it's a
ridiculous.
ludicrous idea.
It is. I love that she thinks this, though, because I relate to this level of twisting in order to
Oh
worry about
my
something.
God. Yeah. Ah,
Strike and Robin both do this, and it's relatable.
Yes,
But
they
this one
do.
really takes the cake for me. It's really funny.
Yeah, I really like this as well. This is good.
She also is thinking about the Ross case and that it's the reason why they're so stretched, and she thinks that it's a fact Strike seemed curiously averse to acknowledging. And this kind of makes me a little sad, especially when you compare it to what Strike is actually thinking right now, that it might be time to sacrifice his ability to do the job he loves in order to free up the agency.
Yeah.
It just makes me really angry at Charlotte and Jago for putting him and them in this situation, and frustrated with Strike and Robin for not communicating with each other better.
Yes.
Strike's thoughts turn to Madeline when she texts him that they need to have a proper talk. Uh-oh.
That's like texting Strike. You need to have a session in the Iron Maiden.
I love the description of, quote, where all strikes relationships went, to the place where expectation met resistance and imploded.
That's some great writing right there.
It
and
really
hilarious.
Is. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I was thinking about Shrike's admission to himself that he shouldn't have lied about where he was staying, but wondered if it's a crime to try and avoid conflict. I think that normally it would have been better just to say that he was staying with Robin. But like I said before, we know that Madeline is already jealous of Robin and doesn't fully believe him because of the lie Charlotte's told her. Kind of makes it a little bit more understandable why he did.
Yeah. And let's be real. He has no particular reason to want to be honest with her.
Yeah.
Because he's not invested in this relationship at all. He mm-hmm. knows that he's going to end it soon. So might as well go with whatever course causes him the least amount of grief.
I know. I mean, honestly, though, he should have already ended this. So that's why I'm still yes. rolling my eyes at him. I'm like, yeah. my boy, you brought this on yourself.
God, it would have been yeah. so good if he'd broken up with her on the phone while Robin was listening. Can you imagine?
Yeah, well, now I'm gonna.
Same.
She would have been standing there with a huge smile on her face during that gravy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
This paragraph is what J.K. Rowling called Strike's best defense when he thinks about the fact that people use each other all the time. And what mm-hmm. I find interesting and exciting is that the reason Strike thinks that Madeline will feel used is if he had explained that he started the relationship with her because of complicated feelings for another woman. I just love that he's admitting feelings for Robin here, because normally he just thinks, well, I know why, but I won't think about it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Complicated feelings. My boy, you're in love. It's really not that complicated. You're just making it complicated. Come on.
Yeah. The moment when he actually refers to it as love to himself, using the actual word, it was, uh-huh. it'll be the moment I just die of glee.
Yeah. yeah, I think that's true for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes me very curious about Robin and Ryan Murphy and if she's ever going to think something similar, because I still think the reason she accepted a date was because she thought about Madeline and what Ilsa said about making Strike jealous. And again, I cannot wait for this book. Have I mentioned it before?
Not yet. Well, not in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So Strike's monologue about trying in a relationship is a bit depressing, because it's all just going through the motions, surface level stuff. That's what he classes as trying. But it makes me curious to see what his trying is going to be like with Robin, because he's definitely going to want to make an effort to make that relationship work. And he's going to want to do the harder, deeper stuff that trying really is with Robin, like honesty, vulnerability, dealing with emotions.
I think it might be a surprise to him just how natural that's going to feel.
Yeah.
It's not going to feel like trying as much, because it's just going to be how he wants to be with her.
Aww.
I hope, I think.
Yeah, I hope.
Yeah.
And in regards to using people, he also thinks about Madeline's desire to post pictures of him on Instagram and showing people you've snagged a prize. I think he's probably right there. What do you guys think?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Madeline's image and brand is only intensified by her dating such a famous, successful, and sexy man. I mean, it would definitely boost her professionally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think this is the main reason she's dating him, but it is a yeah. nice bonus for her.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice perk,
mm-hmm.
I would
mm-hmm.
think.
I like the fact yeah. that you pointed out that he was sexy in there. That was a nice touch.
We always like when that gets added in. We're fans of that.
Oh, yeah.
But now at the end of the chapter, they get to the Epcots and they see that Gus and Inigo are driving somewhere and they follow. I have to say that I felt really bad for Gus when I read this part, that Inigo is just yelling at him in the car for so long. And honestly, I still kind of do, because I think it's possible that Gus could have been a different person had he not had an abusive father.
Yeah, I agree that Inigo's abuse probably played a huge role in shaping Gus to become what he did. And I feel really bad for little kid Gus for being subjected to that. At a certain point, you know, he chose to do what he's done as an adult, and he's kind of lost my sympathy there, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, it's just an endless cycle for me. Of yeah. what could have been. I feel yeah. bad for what could have been.
It doesn't excuse Gus for what he becomes, but it explains it, you know, yeah. and it does make you sad that there are people like that in the world.
I think that's why she puts so much emphasis on parenting in these books.
Yeah, because it really shapes a child.
Mm-hmm.
That to me, sometimes I think about that. It's like the one thing that if everybody had, it would make such a huge difference. And that is, as a child, you know that you are unconditionally loved.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe that's the main ingredient that human beings need from the very beginning.
Yeah. Now I need my emotions closet after that. And then the chapter ends with them arriving at the other Epcot home and making a plan to go and speak to Inigo. Was anyone nervous about how he was going to respond?
I was looking forward to getting more reasons to hate him. I'm like, yes, yeah. This dickwad, let's go.
Yep, you know it's coming.
Yeah, I feel like I related to Robin because I think you can tell that she's slightly apprehensive about it. Mm. And Strike is just so confident with these things. It reminds me of that part in Silkworm where he goes up to the door and that officer is upset and Robin's a little nervous but amazed by Strike.
Yeah, I love that.
To me, this moment feels like that moment. Mm. That's the vibe I get.
Interesting. I do love that bit in Silkworm.
Yeah, me too.
So good.
Okay, chapter 77.
Here we have Strike interviewing Inigo Epcot. So the epigraph, "You weep. I had such lofty aims. My soul had yearnings truly great. Then broken altars, dying flames. I had deserved a better fate." And that's Failures by May Kendall.
Okay. I think that this is Inigo's feelings about his own life. Mm-hmm. All the goals he had that he feels he missed out on because of his diagnosis. There's a line later in the chapter where Inigo says, "I happen to know exactly how it feels to be cut off in one's prime, to know that one could have excelled only to watch others succeed while one's own world shrinks around one and one's," God, he says one so much, it's obnoxious, isn't it?
He's so pompous.
And yeah. "And one's hopes for the future are dashed."
I think you're spot on here that this is what these lines are referring to. The poem itself really embodies Inigo's attitude and also completely slams him. So the speaker in the poem accuses the failure, we'll call Inigo the failure, because okay, that's who it is in the poem, of thinking that their failures are so much more tragic than anyone else's. Because yeah, this mm-hmm. failure thought that he was the most special and that he deserved the greatest success. So he's the real tragic figure. Whereas the speaker is lecturing him to get some goddamn perspective. Literally everyone has disappointments and failures. You're not special.
That really sounds just like him.
Inigo, 100%.
I want to jump into the chapter a little bit for this mm-hmm. epigraph because it made me wonder what Strike's thoughts would be about this. The line I just read about Inigo causes him to get a little emotional, and it says, "But if Inigo Epcot was expecting sympathy from Strike, he was disappointed. He who'd once lain on a dusty road in Afghanistan, his own leg blasted off with the severed torso of a man who'd minutes previously been bantering about a drunken stag night in Newcastle, lying beside him, had no pity to spare for Inigo Epcot's crushed dreams. If Epcot's work colleagues and bandmates hadn't been inclined to generosity, Strike was ready to bet it had been due to the bullying, self-aggrandizing nature of the man sitting opposite him, rather than any lack of compassion. The older Strike got, the more he'd come to believe that in a prosperous country, in peacetime, notwithstanding those heavy blows of fate to which nobody was immune, and those strokes of unearned luck of which Inigo, the inheritor of wealth, had clearly benefited, character was the most powerful determinant of life's course."
Yeah, I mean, I think your analysis is spot on. I mean, this is such a powerful passage and it totally backs that up. It
really works with the message of the poem.
I just really like seeing Strike's thoughts about it because we don't get a ton of his thoughts about some of the mm-hmm. people in this book who are dealing with disability or illness. And here we get it, and it's really good.
I want to hear Strike's thoughts on all things at all times.
Me too.
He's got good thoughts.
He does. It's almost like someone writing him has good thoughts. It's weird.
And I was going to say too, really quickly, that this emphasis on character that Strike has is so J.K. Rowling. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing with Harry Potter is it's the choices you make. Yeah. And that's what character is.
Oh my God. I'm having emotions now about Harry Potter.
Yeah. I find it endearing every time it mentions Strike loving the sea. I think I find that endearing because I feel the same way. Yesterday when we were driving in San Diego, I didn't realize how close we were. And I was like, oh, there's the ocean. And I was trying to get Jack to look.
Oh.
Yeah, I think I have that too.
Huh.
But I feel like we get more of the whole sea thing with Strike in this book than we have before. I wonder if Joan had anything to do with that or if we're just seeing the sea more.
I think that the Cornish born and always in this, that frame it as sort of a lifelong feeling. But even absent specific mention of Joan, I have to believe that he briefly thinks of her.
And now that I mention it, I bet we're going to get even more mentions of the sea in the running grave if a body's found in the water.
I wonder if Strike will think some kind of contrast of this beautiful ceremony setting Joan's ashes to sea and whatever horrible shit has led to the victim in the running grave floating up.
I feel like that is going to absolutely happen. And we're going to talk about this moment.
That would be amazing.
I feel like that's very likely, actually.
Fingers crossed. My prediction rating will go up.
It will. So the Epcot house here in Whitstable is called Aquarell Cottage. And first of all, the photos of this area are really nice. You can see them all on Strike Fans. It looks like a nice place to visit or have a second home, I guess. But more importantly, it says that the house has a stained glass fan window over the door, depicted a galleon in full sail. Maybe it's a reach, but I feel like this could be a clue connecting back to the stained glass at North Grove.
Maybe it's foreshadowing, and Strike and Robin will find paradise, Eden, on a boat in the Running Grave. Prediction: a millionaire client gets Corbin and Robin to his yacht for a party / meeting / intrigue, and then they kiss. And if anyone out there doesn't know what I'm talking about and thinks I'm just saying crazy things, go read the second part of the two-part blog post series that we just posted by Beatrice Groves, where she talks about images of Eden in stained glass windows in Ink Black Heart. Because the thing is that the first two stained glass were depictions of Eden, paradise. And the first one was Eden. The second one was what North Grove was intended to be, Eden. And then the third glass with their names on it promised a paradise in the future. I feel like it's foreshadowing, and that Strike and Robin will find paradise on a boat in the Running Grave.
I was just thinking that another stained glass was like an X, that like Anime is here.
Oh, okay. Maybe.
Just like with the first Epcot interview, it's Gus that opens the door. And this time it says that upon seeing Strike and Robin, his expression turned to horror. This could be a clue. Why else would he be horrified to see them?
The first time you're reading this, you might think that Gus is horrified because of what his father will do.
Yeah.
But second time through, this must have been a moment of pure panic for him, especially because he's planning on killing his best friend tonight. You're getting ready to set off on your murder plot, and suddenly two private detectives show up on your doorstep. You're going to be shitting bricks.
That's what he's saying to his dad. I have to go.
Yeah.
Oh my God, how did I never put that together?
He pretended he had special tutoring. He has to drive up to Cambridge to kill his buddy.
Oh my God.
Right.
I told you that timeline stuff is not my strength. I did not realize that that's why he was leaving.
Wow.
And he's walking with Strike and Robin.
He was so eager to go kill Morehouse that he didn't want to go buy milk first.
I
wouldn't want to buy milk for an eagle either.
No, I wouldn't either. He can have a milkless life.
No milk for you.
Come back one year. I think Strike is hilarious in this chapter. He cracks me up when Inigo is furious and asks if they've been following, and he thinks, obviously we have, you pompous prick. But it's also just his mourning that's so funny too. I feel like Strike really enjoys irritating horrible people.
Honestly, it's one of his most endearing qualities. Hating pedophiles, irritating horrible people, man of my dreams. Yeah.
This chapter feels like it has that vibe of when he pretends to look back at his notebook, or when he pretends to write.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Oh, that was so brilliant. Good.
Yeah, I love when he does that.
I love him.
Also, the fact that he purposely raises his voice because people are walking by is really funny.
Yes.
So good. Listen,
for some reason, I can imagine Tom Burke playing this moment absolutely perfectly. It's right there.
I know exactly what you mean. I can't explain it either, but I can see it. I feel like I've already watched it.
Yeah. Oh, I hope they keep that in. I really hope they do, because it's just, that's Tom Burke right there.
Yeah, I really cracked up at Inigo pompously saying, at least that's how I heard it, to what do I owe this intrusion into my privacy? And Strike answering Kia Niven. And then the twitchy, convulsive response that Inigo has is like, because I mean, the shock, you know, you can just see it.
Another funny moment is a little later when Inigo says that he didn't tell Katya he was speaking to Kia because of patient confidentiality. And Strike says, I didn't realize you were a doctor. He's just so funny.
He is.
He's absolutely loving annoying Inigo Epcot. I know I would. Maybe that's why I enjoy this so much. Or maybe because Funny Strike is just enjoyable.
Chef's kiss.
I also really like Robin judging Inigo's paintings that are hanging on the wall.
Robin judging anything is always my favorite.
It is. She's really good at it.
Yeah, she's great. I wonder if these pictures are Inigo's or if they've hung up Katya's paintings. I feel like Robin should have given an insincere compliment and asked who did them to get a gauge on like the artistic talent level. My question is, so you're a parent, you have an incredibly talented artist as a son. Gus is a shithead, but he's really good at drawing stuff. you would know, and you would have his work hung around the place, right? If you were a normal good parent.
I guess so. Maybe he hides it from them.
I guess what I'm just saying is the fact that they don't seem to have any knowledge of their son being a fantastic artist, it just sort of shows the disconnection in this family. Like, these parents don't seem connected to these kids at all. And especially Gus, they have no idea who he is, what he's become.
On a more lighthearted note, going back to Robin being judgy, I have to say that Robin being judgy about bad art is probably my new favorite fun fact about Robin from this book.
I love her so much. I want to hear her judgments on everything and everyone.
Reading Robin talking shit is just chef's kiss.
While they're confronting Inigo about his relationship with Kia, Gus is supposed to be unpacking. Do you think that Gus has this house bugged too? I'm guessing not, and that's why he's sitting there listening at the stairs. But I bet he was seriously bummed that he had to go to the store and couldn't stay and listen.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe he was able to set something up before leaving.
I agree with you. Probably doesn't have this place bugged already. Would he have been able to get a listening device in to catch us without Corman and Robin seeing him? Because, you know, they're very good detectives.
I don't know. It's just knowing that he's Anemy, how could he just leave and not hear what they're saying?
Yeah.
If I was Gus, that would absolutely kill me.
Yeah.
Because you want to know.
Ugh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was too arrogant to think that they couldn't possibly be on to him. He's safe. They're just here about Kia.
Yeah. Once he got over his initial shock.
Here's the next line that I thought was interesting. Remembering Katja's claim to have felt maternal towards Josh Blay, Robin couldn't decide whether she felt more distaste or compassion for the miserable Upcotts, who'd each, it seemed, sought solace and perhaps the hope of a recovered youth through their relationships with 20-somethings.
Well, first of all, I don't like this way of thinking in general. Mm-hmm. Now, specifically here, maybe it applies. I mean, definitely with Inigo. I mean, I'm not so sure about, just because Katja claims to have felt maternal, I don't quite understand why that would make her having hope of a recovered youth or seeking solace from it.
I think because it was a lie, that she doesn't feel maternal towards him. She feels romantic feelings for him.
There were definitely implications that it was romantic.
Do you think so? Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I wasn't reading that as much into it. But anyway, so specifically, this way of thinking obviously applies here. But I think that often there is this way of thinking in general where people don't think it's possible for older people to be actual friends with young adults. And I've, you know, had it both ways, where I've, as a younger person, had a lot older friends. And then now that I'm an older person, I've got younger friends. And I think that, you know, we should all strive to have a wide range of ages among our friends. You know, you get wisdom from your older friends, your younger friends maybe keep you hip and vice
I'm
versa.
I'm always hip.
Yeah. Oh.
No, my younger cousins are like, oh my God, Lindsay, you sound so old.
Very much like a hello fellow youth. No, I agree with your general point. Intergenerational friendships are important.
Very.
Specifically for women, because part of devaluing the wisdom of older women.
Yes.
Anyway, it's a feature of patriarchy, devaluing older women. Anyway, I agree with your general point. Intergenerational friendships can be really, really good and really important. But as we said in the specifics here, I think it's the romantic inclinations that Katja and Inigo are both implied to have, I think, pretty powerfully. It's what makes it a bit...
Strike also does a good job at getting information by making Inigo angry, which is also very entertaining.
Yes.
He makes a statement, not a question, that Inigo has met Kia in person. And after Inigo loses it and has a coughing fit, Strike says that he was only asking a question. And I just think it's such a fun way to get an answer. Really smart detective work right there. Knowing that he'd never get the real answer, honestly. So framing it as a fact and basically tricking the answer out of him is genius.
You know, that's real big detective energy right there.
Classic BDE.
Classic. I also like that Robin is genuinely worried about what they do if Inigo has a heart attack.
See, I just assumed that they'd use as an excuse to search the house without pretending to need to the bathroom. While you're waiting for the ambulance, just go have a quick sneaky peek and see.
It's funny that they didn't use the "can I use your bathroom?"
Yeah.
I bet they would have known. I bet they knew that that wouldn't have been successful.
Yeah. Inigo wasn't really giving them room for that.
No. One thing I really like is how Strike disarms Inigo with facts about Kia. that she had made threats against Josh and Edie the night before they were stabbed, and that she's been sleeping with Wally Cardew. Do we think that Kia was making Inigo think that there was a little something-something going on? I kind of get that impression.
Yep, I am certain that Kia was very good at keeping this guy on the hook. Just by suggesting that there might be the potential for a little something-something, as you say, so eloquently.
Yeah, thank you.
And Paula also eloquently with the ugh, really sums up everyone's response to this.
I think this chapter does a pretty good job at making Kia seem like a good suspect again. Not only mentioning the threats the night before, but also showing that Inigo had passed along information to her about the Ink Black Heart.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why Gus feels like he can leave, because he hears them leaning towards
Kia. Yeah, because the focus is on Kia. So he's like, oh, I'm in the clear. Ew. Time to go do my murder.
Here's the part where Inigo says that Kia can't be Anami because Yasmin is Anami. And I was just wondering, I feel like I know the answer to this, but did any of you think that Yasmin was Anami?
Hell no.
I absolutely never did either, but I have never gotten one right in all these books yet. Yeah. So yeah. I couldn't entirely rule her out.
Yeah. Neither have I, but I still was 100% laughing about at this one. I'm like, Yasmin is Anami? No.
Maybe I just didn't think so because we've been able to see the private mod chats and see the way the Anami is with her. Maybe that influenced it, but I also didn't think so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, why would Anami have a private chat with himself? Blackmailing himself into pretending to be himself. So that's pretty, we know that's nonsense by this stage.
The story he tells about Yasmin saying she was Anami to Nils when they were kissing at the Christmas party, I need to go look this up, but I can't remember why she said this, if she had. And now I'm also imagining kissing someone with little cat teeth, and it's weird.
Now I'm imagining it too, and it is really
sorry
weird. But if I had to guess, I'd say that Nils was probably blathering on about Anami, the concept, and Yasmin would have been like, I'm Anami, in an emo, like, make him think I'm dark and mysterious kind of way. Yeah, right? Like, oh, I'm the Anami all along. All along? It would have been, I'm Anami?
I'm Anami?
Yeah, I 100% believe that.
In general, this is just another really good Strike chapter for me, because not only is he funny, but the insights we get into Strike's thoughts are really good. There's the stuff we talked about for the epigraph, but also at the end it says, but whose fault is it, said Strike, getting to his feet. He was tired of this petulant, arrogant, embittered man and disliked the contrast between the way he treated his children and the solicitude he displayed towards a pretty young woman who'd groomed him so expertly. That you hid from your wife, that you've been chatting up Kia Niven on the sly.
I love that Strike drops this bomb in front of Gus just to be a shit stirrer.
Oh, me too.
It's delightful. Also, Strike's concerned about good parenting.
Yeah.
It's serious business for him.
This goes towards the thing we've talked about so much before, doesn't
so
it?
So often, like dad energy.
And then the final line, Robin saw Gus look around wide-eyed as he closed the fridge. For a brief moment, Inigo appeared winded. Then he said in a low growl, get the hell out of my house. I think it's such a good ending to the chapter. And when I first read it, I felt really happy that Strike had done this in front of Gus, because I felt like it gave Gus something to feel, I don't know, better about. Like, this man who's so abusive towards him, but this detective just told me a huge secret that he can use against him and maybe feel like he has the upper hand. I don't know.
I'm curious about how you feel now reading it, because I'm personally really entertained by it still. I hate Inigo enough that I don't really care whether his psychopath son gets this little juicy tidbit of blackmail material. So
yeah, no, I'm completely with you. I still really enjoy this part. Sometimes I feel like Inigo is the umbrage of this book, because even though Gus is the killer, I kind of hate this guy more sometimes, you know?
yeah, definitely.
And I think he's a good person to blame for how Gus turned out. So, you know, whatever.
Is this the last time we see Inigo alive? Because if so, that's exciting for us.
It might be.
Good riddance.
Bye, Inigo. It's been fun.
No, it's been terrible. Good riddance.
All right, we made it to the end. Those were fun chapters.
Yes.
Yeah, they were.
Well, I'm glad you were here for these ones, Paula. Thanks for joining us.
I know. Well, I chose them purposefully. You gave me the choice. I really appreciated that.
Well, what are we doing next time, Kens?
In the next episode, we're going to be doing chapters 78 through 82. And in these chapters, we see Strike and Madeline breaking up.
Finally. Thank God. Finally.
Ah, right? And then Robin gets in contact with Rachel Ledwell and interviews her as well.
Aww, nice.
I love that.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.